Hello, podcast listeners. This is Brian Dillman at Rational Faiths, a Mormon-based blog and podcast seeking to provide a safe, fair, and balanced space to discuss the complexities, difficulties, and beauty of our Mormon tradition. In an entertaining and informal way, we are dedicated to exploring the vital, applicable, and expansive topics that we are all working with as Mormons, while simultaneously working to keep Mormonism weird. That's what we do here at Rational Faith, and a few announcements are in order. We are on iTunes, and we are also have our feed into Stitcher. For those of you using Android devices, this will be a little easier to find the podcast and listen to it. Please check us out there at iTunes and Stitcher, and take some time to leave a positive rating. Today on the podcast, we have an interview led by Laurel. She and Mike have talked with Mormon playwright Melissa Leilani Larson. They discuss her background, what it is like to write dialogue in comparison to prose, and how being Mormon does or does not affect her writing. Several of her past and current projects are discussed, and little bits of fun and wisdom are passed along the way. Have a listen, folks. I think you'll enjoy it.
So, hello, this is Laurel Armstrong. I am here interviewing the wonderfully talented Melissa Leilani Larson. You can say hello, Melissa.
Hello.
We also have Michael Barker. Is that your hello, Michael?
Oh, yes, I'm Mike Barker. It's good to be with you. It's good to be Laurel's arm candy today.
Right. So we're just going to interview Melissa. She is she just finished writing the screenplay to Freetown, which is a movie that is currently filming. And do you want to just give a very brief overview of that?
Sure. It's based on a true story, I should say, inspired by a true story of Native Liberian LDS missionaries who were serving in the capital of Liberia in Africa during the time that the Liberian Civil War broke out in 1989 and 1990. And basically these missionaries, because of the war, were unable to teach, and they wanted to continue teaching and had to basically flee Liberia to do so. And it's a really exciting story. It's really engaging, and it's kind of miraculous. So it actually is really good fodder for a thriller, for a film.
Excellent. And we'll ask for more details as we go on in this podcast. We'll go a little more into it. But Mel has a large body of work. She won the Mormon Arts and Letters for her play Little Happy Secrets, which I actually starred in its first iteration. It has had several other productions since then. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, I just kind of want to start with your background, Mel, and basically, you know, what is your 5-minute life story?
I was born and raised in Hawaii. I am a lifelong member of the church, and my parents met when BYU Hawaii was still the Church College of Hawaii. We came to the mainland, to Utah, which is where I attended junior high and high school, and BYU, yay, where I studied English. And then I got into theater accidentally. It was just for kicks and giggles. I took a playwriting class my senior year at BYU, and it was an incredibly difficult class. It was taught by playwright Elizabeth Hansen, and she was very knowledgeable. She's a great writer and a great actress, and she was very hard on me. I had planned to be a novelist up until then, and I had a lot of teachers give me, you know, pretty glowing reviews of anything I gave them, and I kind of coasted through undergrad until I got to Liz's class, and Liz was like, hey, this is bad, go back and do it again. And I'd never had a teacher do that to me, and I couldn't even remember having a teacher do that to me ever. And so I did, and I was like, this is so terrible. Why is this so hard? And writing dialogue was just so different than writing prose. But somewhere in that class, I clicked into it, and Liz told me, "Hey, guess what? You're a playwright." And since then, that's what I've done. I've done, I've been writing plays, and I started the master's in theater at BYU, but ended up transferring to the University of Iowa to get the more terminal degree, the Master of Fine Arts in playwriting. And I have taught adjunct in theater, and I've been writing theater and film and having stuff produced lots of places at the university level, and hoping to make the jump to the more professional level, and to get, you know, paid for stuff. It's really nice to like be almost doing what you want for a job. It's really cool.
And get paid for what you went to school for.
It's amazing.
So if, you know, if we're going to make a lifetime movie about your life, it would probably focus on this class would be the big turning point.
Potentially, which would make for a really boring movie. But
well, they would definitely spice it up and add things that didn't really happen. But
yeah, no, it's true. I probably, you know, especially things that, well, I don't know. You never know what happens behind closed doors at BYU. But it was very much a turning point, because it was just writing drama is just so different than writing prose. I mean, because you are writing from a much more omniscient point of view when you're writing prose, and you're kind of creating the world and describing things and even going as far as describing how people are feeling and what their intentions are. And in drama, you kind of partner with the actor and outline what that could be, but you kind of have to trust the actor and the director to bring it to fruition and bring it to life.
So was writing something you always wanted to do your entire life, or is that also something in general that you kind of found accidentally?
It's something I've always wanted to do. It's something that I always have done. I was always writing stories and playing make-believe when I was quite small. I read from a very, very young age, and I have my dad to thank for that, because he taught me to read. I've just been reading and making up stories for as long as I can remember. And so it's always been something that I wanted to do. And it was just a matter of, I guess, finding the right medium. I would still like to do prose at some point. And sometimes, you know, it's all about servicing the story. And there are stories that are meant to be told in prose, and there are stories that are meant to be drama. It takes a very particular kind of story to work across media.
Well, I was going to ask you, so when you switched over to doing playwriting, what were some of the, I'm sure at first it was kind of, as you said, it was very difficult at first, but what were some of the new freedoms that you found in being able to tell the story through dialogue and through a play and, you know, a dramatic story versus through prose?
Well, the trick to writing drama is that everything, or at least the majority of everything information-wise that you're trying to communicate to the audience, needs to come out in either the dialogue or the action on stage. And the easy thing about prose, and easy is a relative word, because, you know, writing is not easy no matter what form you're in. But the nice thing about writing prose is that you have control. You can basically explain things in the narrative. And one of the difficulties / challenges / really cool thing, if you can overcome it in drama, is to give all of that information to the audience with the limited capability of dialogue and of stage picture and action on stage. So everything just kind of has to unravel in front of the audience and make sense. And so it's if I were to say that there was something that was a freedom there that you don't really have as much of access to when you're writing prose, in the theater you have a lot more control over creating, I think, characters that are really well-rounded and interesting and become real honest people, and you really get to see real people in situations that could happen to anybody anywhere. Does that make sense?
To me, it does. Being an actor.
Being an actor. Get to play pretend all the time.
Well, let me rehash from from caveman's point of view of what you just said. So you're saying with when you're writing for a play. I think I'm going to totally mess up what you actually just said. What I heard is when you're writing for a play, that it seems that you're leaving a little bit more to the imagination of the viewer. While if you're writing a pro, and I'm ignorant, I think by pros you mean like you're writing a story to be read as opposed to being played out, that you're actually kind of telling the reader what to think.
Yes. No, I think that's a good way to say it. Yeah, prose, when I say prose, I'm talking about text that you read, like a novel or a short story,
okay,
fiction or nonfiction. And in a play, you do have you do leave a lot to the imagination. And you also leave a lot to interpretation, to actors and the designers, because the cool thing about a book, about a novel, is that it's different for every reader who reads it. They're going to read it differently. They're going to respond to it. They're going to bring their own personal experience to it. And what's cool about drama, either theater or film, is, what's really cool about theater is that when a play is produced, every time it's produced, it's different. And because you're going to have a different director, you're going to have a different cast of actors, you're going to have different designers. So the show is going to look and feel and sound different, even though the text is always the same. With a film, there's a little bit more sense of finality. It's made to only be done the one time. But right now in our culture, we have this problem with revamping everything. We can't seem to do anything original in Hollywood right now.
What?
We are just revising. So it's actually kind of funny that one of the cool things about theater is actually one of the more annoying things about Hollywood, that we just keep coming back to tell the same story again and again.
I never thought about that. So a play is more open to interpretation, not just by the audience, but also by the person that is that's actually putting on the play, then, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Which I guess makes sense when I actually think about it, because I live in Southern Oregon, and so Ashland's like 10 minutes away from us, and they have this big Shakespeare Festival, right? And I mean,
every
year.
Awesome.
So every year it's like, I mean, they cycle through different plays, but you know, Romeo and Juliet's going to pop up, you know, once every 3 years. Like, oh, really? Again? You know, but it's you know, always a little different. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thank you. That's something interesting to chew on.
That's one of the things about theater that I love, is that possibility that it's because also, I mean, even the audience is going to be different. I mean, you're going to have a different crowd of people, unless you have people who, and there are people who are total Romeo and Juliet fanatics who are just going to go every time somebody does Romeo and Juliet. But then you're also just going to have, in general, your audience is going to be different, not just from show to show, but from night to night. So yeah. The interaction between the audience and the actor also affects that performance, which is, you can't really duplicate that in any other art form.
I was curious also if there was a bit of a transition when you first started writing writing from prose, where everything is just the author. You know, I'm sure you have editors and stuff, but mainly it's all your idea. It's all your, you know, you never hear someone else's interpretation of it unless it's getting reviewed. But was it a hard transition at first when you were playwriting to getting used to people interpreting things in ways you had no intention of them to be interpreted?
Yes. And it still happens. And it's one of those things that you kind of have to, it's one of those things you just kind of have to roll with. Because sometimes an actor will read a monologue that you've written and it will be different than you imagined, but also brilliant. And directors are going to come in and say, oh, hey, if we set this scene in this location instead, and at first my gut instinct is to go, no, wait, I put it in that location for a very specific reason. But then you kind of need to be open to directors trying things, because sometimes you find something in the scene you didn't intend that is great, that is fantastic. And one of my favorite things is when people come up to me after a show, audience members, and they will say, hey, I got this out of your show and I felt this and it was really great. And did you mean for me to come away with this? And 99% of the time, no matter what they say, no matter how they fill in that question, did you mean for me to come away thinking this? I go, yes. Because the hope is that someone is just going to make an emotional connection, that they're going to come away somehow better thinking about things differently. And I can't really judge all the different ways that a show can be interpreted by, you know, if you have a audience size that averages 100 and 150 people, every one of those people is going to have a different reaction to the show. And so when someone finds that connection, that's where I put my intention, is for people to have a connection. I find that if I try to assign a specific message, then it gets in the way of the storytelling. If I say that I'm going to tell the story as well as I can and hope that people have an emotional connection, people come away with all kinds of messages, and I can say, okay, good. Yes, I totally meant for you to feel that way afterward.
So my next question then, and it will tie back to what you were just talking about, is how does your faith influence your work? Like, for example, are there certain topics that you feel especially interested in, or is it kind of a non, you know, it doesn't really influence that way? Are there certain topics you won't go into, or are there sometimes things, do you ever have like the Mormon shame voice in the back of your head telling you you shouldn't be writing about this? Like, just in what way has it, you know, just influenced in any way your work?
My faith is really important to who I am as a person, and therefore it just makes sense that it plays into my writing. I do hesitate when people try to put me into a category and assume that I'm going to write a certain thing because I'm an LDS writer, because I'm an LDS woman. For me, I am all about the story. I want to write a story that is compelling and engaging and honest and as real as possible, and that can be relatable to the audience. And if that story just happens to be LDS in nature or in content, I'm not opposed to that. And I will let that part of me show through in my work. But I don't, you know, kill myself trying to find, I'm not trying to be the Mormon Shakespeare by any stretch of the imagination. It's just what's great about Mormon culture is that it's very interesting. There's a lot of fodder for writing. And sometimes I think Mormon artists are a little tentative to attack it, to go after those stories. Because the audience is a little sensitive about it. Mormons both want to see themselves on stage and on screen at the same time that they don't, if that makes any sense. So if I have a story that has LDS characters and an LDS story and is interesting and engaging, then yes, I want to tell it. But I also am really interested in a wide variety of stories and content. And I also myself find spirituality in a lot of different things. So I think my faith plays in when I'm adapting Austin or when I'm, you know, telling other stories that aren't necessarily straight up LDS.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to go back to something you said, because I took a screenwriting class at BYU years ago, and something, it was from Daryl Larson, and he said something that really stuck with me about LDS viewers, is that he said, you know, in church, we're shown what basically amounts to, and he didn't say this in like a negative way, but we're shown what amounts to propaganda in that it's very affirming of a certain viewpoint. And he said that's actually the appropriate place for it. That's where we're affirming, you know, our beliefs, affirming certain things. And so part of the problem, though, is that we get used to that. We associate that kind of media with our faith. And so when Richard Dutcher comes in with God's Army, and even though it's still very faith affirming, it shows things in a more realistic light. People get very uncomfortable because they're not used to seeing that it's not propaganda anymore. It's a more realistic portrayal that's actually more how regular movies are, you know, are shown. That's the narrative form that most Americans are used to, is this more realistic view of things. And he was just talking about the tension that we have in Mormon media, of this tension between the ideal that we see in church videos, and this is the ideal, and that's the place to show the ideal is at church, versus when we're trying to tell stories outside of the church and people have a hard time letting go of the ideal because we have to explore what the reality is. And so I was just wondering, like, if that's part of the struggle sometimes, if you have to write something for a Mormon audience, if those kinds of thoughts come in, or if you ever, when you're writing, if you ever specifically write for a Mormon audience, or if it's just, you just let the story be told.
To be honest, I seldom, for me, for my personal sanity and artistic progression, I guess, I don't aim for the Mormon audience because of those issues that you raise. I disagree personally. I'm uncomfortable watching the ideal. I would rather watch the real. Perfect people are boring, so there's no room for them in the theater. Because we don't go to a show, to a movie or a TV show or a play to watch perfect people because they are boring. They always make the right choice. They're not making choices. They are just being good. And we go to, when we're entertained, we are looking for conflict, and that's what we relate to, and that's what we learn from. So I react more to situations that have conflict. And that, for me, that's a better situation to learn from. My discomfort with the ideal comes with this, when people take it a little too far, when people look at the ideal and it's one thing to say, you know, I want to be closer to Christ. I want to be like Christ. Christ was a perfect person, and I want to be more like him, and I work toward that every day. There is nothing wrong with striving with perfection, but there is something wrong with having perfect expectations, because that is an unrealistic goal. Does that make sense? So it's like, I feel sometimes when we show the ideal, people take it not as, as a guideline, but as what they're not. And that is uncomfortable to me. It's like, oh, hey, this is, none of us are perfect. But we should try to be perfect. So I'm going to show you perfect people, because you'll only learn from seeing what you're not. So I want to just tell a story, as I said before, as completely and honestly as possible. And so my audience, I'm actually aiming for a non-LDS audience, and I hope that some of the LDS audience will come along for the ride.
So that leads me to Little Happy Secrets, and I'll just give a little background on Little Happy Secrets. I did the original reading of that and performance of it in, I believe that was 2000, was that 2008?
It was, the reading was in 2008, and the stage show was in 2009.
Okay, that's right. And it's a fabulous play, absolutely deserved the Mormon Arts and Letters Award. And why don't you give a brief synopsis of it, Mel?
Sure. I'll give a synopsis. Little Happy Secrets is the story of Claire, who is a recently returned sister missionary. She's come back to BYU and is living in is housemates with her best friend from before her mission, her best friend Brennan, who's also just returned from a mission. And Claire has romantic feelings for Brennan and isn't sure how to broach them.
And there's a great deal of Claire's faith, and that was the thing actually that drew me to it so much, was it was such an honest portrayal of a person. It didn't have an agenda. I just felt this was a story and this was a person that this just happened to. It wasn't preaching one way or the other. It was just telling a story. And that, as a performer, I loved that because it was a chance to really play something that I didn't feel like I had to be portraying an idea. I was portraying a person. And like Mel, I personally do prefer media that shows the more realistic side of things as opposed to the ideal, though I have learned to appreciate people who do need to see things in the ideal for different reasons. And at times it's nice, but I loved that this story dealt with both the beauty and the heartache of something, that's very difficult for our culture to talk about. And I was also going to ask you, I was there for some of the response at the initial show, and I just wanted you to tell us a little bit too about how the Mormon response was to this show.
Well, when we first, I started talking to, back then in 2008, I was talking to James Goldberg, who was one of the founding members of a little theater company in Provo called the New Play Project. And I was in talks with him about potentially producing Little Happy Secrets in Provo. And when I had first written it, I was in grad school. I was in the final semester of my MFA program at the University of Iowa in the Midwest. And at the time that I wrote it in class, I was nervous because it was the most Mormon thing I had written, the most straight up Mormon thing I had ever written and shared with anyone. And in that classroom, I didn't have any problems with anti-LDS anything while I was in grad school. People were very open and very supportive of me and my faith, in school. And, at the same time though, that they were very unfamiliar with what is a very specific culture. BYU is a very interesting and individual kind of a place. There are things at BYU that you don't experience anywhere else. And I was worried that the play wasn't going to make sense, that it wasn't going to resonate, that it was going to be too churchy, that it was going to be too, was trying too hard to be spiritual. And yet the response from my classmates was actually very positive. And because it was a story and a perspective that they had not been exposed to before. And then coming back to Provo, I was thinking, oh, this play needs to be produced outside of Utah. The last place we're going to do it is in Utah because people are going to do terrible things and they're going to picket and there's going to be, editorials in the paper and everyone's going to be calling for my excommunication and all these terrible things. And then the first production of the play ended up being in Provo, minutes from BYU. Laurel's performance was quite wonderful, and the audience response at first, houses were small, but then there was buzz, and by closing night we were adding chairs, and people responded really, really well to it. It's very possible that there was a negative response to it and I just didn't hear it, but as far as my experience with Utah audiences, the play has been very well received. My favorite response to it has been from people who have said to me, I didn't want to come, but I'm glad that I did. And those are the people that I think the theater is for, that you go to a show thinking one thing and you come away thinking another. And it's never going to be, I don't know if it's going to be as drastic. Little Happy Secrets is about, how we talk to and communicate with people of a different sexual orientation than ours, but, and that's pretty drastic and pretty heavy. And the great thing about drama is that sometimes it can be a much smaller connection, can be something, it can be a much smaller light that we're turning on, but if the light turns on, that's a great thing. And so to hear that there are people who didn't want to come, but came and were changed is really heartening. It's really gratifying.
How hard is it? That's not, I don't know how to ask the question well. So, you know, right, telling the story from the viewpoint of a lesbian woman, what's that like?
It's funny because I tried really, really hard to just really get into Claire's shoes, and the easy thing about it, the nice thing about it was that she and I think have a lot in common as far as personality goes. We like a lot of the same things. If Claire was a real person, we would hang out and that would be cool, you know? And it was, and it's to the point where there are people that have asked me, you know, is this play autobiographical? Is it about you? And it's not. What I tried to do was write it as if it was. Does that make sense? I tried to write it as if it was an autobiography. If I was a lesbian in the church, what would my story be and what would happen? And part of that, of course, also is, you know, things have to happen in a drama. There have to be things have to get heightened and there has to be action and there has to be conflict. But I tried to make her reactions as true and real as they could be. And the most sensible way to do that was for me to say, okay, if this was me, what would I do? It's not, it is a fiction, but that's kind of how I wrote it, was from that perspective.
Yeah, it did have that autobiographical sense and tension and kind of raw grittiness to it for sure. Because, you know, I first listened to it when you had that, you were on that Mormon Expression podcast. Man, that was a while ago. And
it was, 2010.
Sounds fair. And I was, as far as my views on homosexuality, they were changing, but I was still right of center, I would say. And I had a certain uncomfortableness to it, and the story didn't speak to be honest with you, then. And then when I listened to it the second time, I guess this kind of speaks to what you were saying earlier about different audiences interpreting it different. I'm a different audience now, and I listened to it this time with different ears and a different heart, and it was a completely different story for me. It was kind of cool, I guess, or neat or different. I'm not sure what a good word is there, but yeah.
I think that's awesome. That's great. That makes – thank you very much. That really is – yeah, that's gratifying to hear, because it's that hope that that it does something for you. And if it doesn't do something the first time, if it does something the second time, hey, I'm not opposed to that at all. That's great.
Yeah, there's something about telling stories that, as opposed to preaching at someone or speaking at somebody, that seems to change and soften hearts. I think, you know, I think too many times we try to change each other's minds or hearts through rational arguments, and that doesn't work. I think storytelling actually reaches people at an emotional level, and I think it's that at that emotional level where hearts and minds are actually changed. And I think that's kind of what this story, the story that you tell through this play, I think that's what it does.
Thank you very much. That's actually, that was very, very well said, because I think that the power of storytelling is that you, you know, there's an adage that you need to understand someone else's perspective, to empathize with someone else, you need to walk a mile in their shoes, and storytelling gives you that opportunity. If someone just tells you, you know, what another perspective is, we have a tendency, especially today, because we're all so cynical and we are so quick to, you know, draw things along party lines and separate someone else's experience from our own. and just and sometimes we don't even take experience into consideration. We just think about someone's opinion and write them off because it doesn't match ours. And storytelling allows you to experience someone else's story, someone else's perspective. And so whether or not you agree with it, that may or may not happen, but you can at least empathize and understand it better. And you are much more willing to listen in those situations. I think that's why the Savior is, he is the ultimate storyteller, and he uses story and parable and allegory to teach people who wouldn't otherwise listen.
Yeah. Hey, Laura, may I ask her another question?
Go ahead.
So, with that story being told there in the middle of the Jell-O Belt, did you get any pushback from anybody? Anything that you would see as being negative? Dude, why are you telling this story? Or, something worse than that, even.
I'm sure that there was, and it didn't come to me directly.
Okay.
Because there weren't, and it's very possible, for every audience member who comes up to you after a show raving, there could be five who leave, grossly disappointed and never say it aloud. And that's just kind of the way it is. People don't always say, you don't always hear what every person in the audience, how they respond to a show. But I, it's very possible that there was, and I just didn't hear any of it myself directly.
Okay. And I think that's actually a good thing, because I think that we're more often willing to point out the negative than the positive. So I think that speaks to how well done it was, I guess.
So speaking on the whole perspective thing, one thing, and I mentioned this in my very first post I ever wrote for Rational Faiths, I mentioned my experience performing in Little Happy Secrets and how at least that first, that first iteration of the show, we would always have talkbacks, and almost every night someone asked, why didn't you write this about men? Because there is a lot of, if you're familiar with stories about gay Mormons, it's almost all men in theater and art and such. One thing I've always loved about Melissa's writing is that she often takes things from a feminine perspective, but that's not, the point of the story isn't to be like, this is the woman's side of things. It's just, that's just who the character is. The character just happens to be a woman, and this is the story. So I wanted to ask you about that, specifically if you get asked that in a lot of your work, and how you deal with that. If you ever intentionally write characters that are female, or if it just naturally happens because, you feel the most empathy towards women since you are a woman, or any direction you want to go on that topic.
It's interesting because I do remember that about those talkback sessions, those five performances of that show. We did the talkback after each performance, and it was a very popular question. And I think that's what's interesting is that's a question, that someone could apply easily to any play of mine and say, well, why is the protagonist a woman? And my gut response, I think, is that I do empathize with women as a woman. They're working in the theater. There are some wonderful, wonderful, the talent, amazing, amazing actresses working. And for some strange reason, the vast majority of contemporary theater, you could make this argument about Shakespeare, but Shakespeare was 500 years ago. That you look at the Scottish play at Macbeth, and the cast is majority of men. It requires something like 24 men and 3 women. That's the cast of Macbeth. And today in the modern theater, we still have this as an issue where we have these fabulous plays. I mean, there are wonderful, wonderful plays that happen to be written by men and about men, and that's fine. But when it's the majority and we have such wonderful women working in the theater who are not getting the chance to perform in roles that are written for them. There are not nearly enough fascinating roles written for women in middle age, mature, wonderful, smart women. We have, our culture has this, you know, obsession with young, handsome men and young, beautiful, ingenue women, and that's like all we apparently want to see. I don't think that's true. I think that's something that the media and society want us to believe about ourselves. But I think, I like to think audiences are smarter than that and are looking for just good stories about real people. And so I want to write real stories about real women. I want to give actresses stuff to do that is interesting and rewarding. And so a goal with any show that I write is to have at least 1 to 2 really strong roles for women. And if they're the protagonist, rock on. That's awesome. I try to do that. I don't let actresses off the hook very, a lot of the time I give them really hard stuff to do and I say, oh, hey, guess what? You're going to be on stage for the next 90 minutes. Have fun with that. it's demanding and it's hard, but I think it's good. And they, I just think that there is not enough. There's not enough good stuff being created for women to perform. I do consider myself a feminist as far as, hey, I want a fair shake. You know, this is, but at the same time, I also, like I was saying earlier, I kind of cringe at being categorized. I just want to say, I want to write stories that are good. And if those stories happen to be about women, awesome. Because here are these great stories, and I have favorites, you know, I mean, Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams, they write, Arthur Miller, classic American writers who write really great stuff for men. And I can look at their stuff and I admire it and I say, this is a beautiful work of art. But I want to do something like that for women.
So if anyone is not familiar with Mel's work, she does do great plays about women. So if you are a high school drama teacher or you are someone looking for a monologue, if you're an actor, especially period pieces, Mel specializes lately in Austen, Jane Austen plays, but has also written a play called Lady in Waiting. And what's your Joan of Arc ones titled?
It's called Martyr's Crossing.
Martyr's Crossing. That's right.
Yeah,
I thought
so that
it
has
titled something else.
That's got 3 really good roles for women in it. 3 really great. I think they're great, but you know, I'm biased. That actually has been very popular with high schools, the Joan of Arc one. So,
Yeah. And usually the problem in theater is that you have an abundance of women and less parts for them. And you just can't even find enough men to fill all the parts that you have. So like I said, if you're a drama teacher or just someone who needs to do a play or need a monologue, Mel has great stuff for women. And the other thing I wanted to ask about is a lot of your stuff is historical. And so I was just going to ask what your interest is, in historical pieces, because you've recently been doing a lot of Austen plays for BYU and other colleges. And Lady in Waiting is about...
Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII.
And obviously Martyr's Crossing is Joan of Arc. So just tell us a little bit about your interest in history.
Well, I have at this point, do I have to count for a minute? I might need to stop and count on my fingers. 13 plays that have been produced in some form or another. And the majority of those, and the majority is shrinking, are either historical in nature, or I do have the 2 adaptations of Austen, and I'm planning to do more Austen adaptations. History has always been really fascinating to me. I think that to look back in time, to look at, for example, I really have a do I want to use the word obsession in an audio recording that will live forever on the interwebs? I kind of have had an obsession with British specifically British monarchy and history, Hawaiian monarchy and Hawaiian history. I just think that those, the royal families and their interactions and their comings and goings are so, so interesting. And the fact that, that the UK still has, you know, a royal family, and that they are so steeped in certain traditions, that's just really interesting to me. And so I've always just been attracted to history, to getting to know people who lived before and how they did things differently than we do now, and how they interacted with each other. So that's just always been really interesting as far as I can, as long as I can remember. I've been really into history and read a lot of history books and spent a lot of time in the historical section of the library. And I have also realized that I kind of have a little bit of a knack for heightened language. I think that there are things that certain, as a writer, you find that you have, there are strengths within your strength, that writing for me, it's writing is what I do, but there are certain things within, under that umbrella that I do particularly well. And for me, one of those things that I like to think I have a knack for is heightened language, is period speech. That's why I think Jane Austen and I get along so well, is she is very witty and very smart and very, very, very funny, and also very real and very honest about, she wrote so, unfortunately, so little. I mean, and maybe I shouldn't just say, you know, having never written a novel, that six novels is not very much at all. But in comparison, you know, to Dickens, who got paid by the word and has volumes, there's volumes and volumes of Dickens. And he also lived so much longer than Jane Austen lived, but that she had such a small literary footprint, and yet her influence is huge. And I think it's because she wrote about what she knew. She wrote about people that she knew. And she was a feminist. She wrote stories about women and for women, but she did not, in her stories, trivialize or marginalize men. The relationships between men and women are actually the core of what her stories are all about. And so her character building is just kind of fantastic. I think a lot of people will look at first glance and say that all of her books are exactly the same. And they really aren't. The characters are incredibly individual and very different, from Pride and Prejudice to Sense and Sensibility to Emma. And the wit and the language is just kind of fantastic. So I just kind of, that's something that I think I also do really well. And so I try to take that period language, and there is something about it that has to be different on stage. I mean, you can't just take Pride and Prejudice on stage and just read it. I mean, that would require a performance and it would be great, but it would also be something like 18 hours long. So you have to compress things down for time and distill things and heighten things for drama. And then also take the language and make it, while you keep that period feeling, you need to help it. Yeah, help is right, the right word. You kind of have to help it be understood by a modern audience.
Excellent. So which, just for our audience, which Jane Austen stories have you adapted for theater, and which are you planning to do in the future?
The very first one I did was my personal favorite of the Austen novels, and that was Persuasion, which was the last novel she wrote before she died. Because it's, for me, it was just the most, it's just kind of a devastating story. It's about, a couple that, were engaged when they were quite young, and her family put pressure on her to break it off. And then 8 years later, this couple is brought back together again. And you don't know, in the reading of the novel, you don't know if they're going to make it. And the text is really quite beautiful. So that was the first, it was my first adaptation of any kind. And it was also my first Austen. And it's been produced at several universities, since I first, wrote it, and I think it was, we did a stage reading of that in 2008, and it's been produced at three different universities and a local theater company since then. And then last year, 2013, was the anniversary, the 200th anniversary of the publishing of Pride and Prejudice. And BYU commissioned me to adapt Pride and Prejudice for them. So that show just went up in March of this year. And I, as far as which one, I would like to do them all. I would like to do the canon. I think that would be a good, it would be good for me. Because as I was saying before, the characters are all so different. There are so many different ways to tell these stories on stage. I would love to do any of them, which is why I'm probably going to do all of them. The next one I'm looking at right now is I'm kind of torn between, Northanger Abbey, which I think, you could have a lot of fun doing it in the black box, small and, makes fun of Gothic stories. So you could make a scare an audience and make them laugh at the same time. That could be a lot of fun.
So, you mentioned how you're interested in royalty and stuff, and kind of in passing, you mentioned, you know, Hawaiian royalty. And I wonder if you've had any interest in kind of further exploring that, because here's, as a non-Polynesian, looking at the church, some of the most faithful members are Polynesian, yet the only thing we know about them is that they do luau's, and they play football, or if they live in West Valley, they're gang members, right? That's all Mormon culture sees of them. And there seems like there could be like so much more in that culture that could be explored either in writing or in, you know, in a play like you're talking about. Have you ever considered that, to kind of show that Polynesians aren't just those four categories?
Yes, actually I have. And I would love to. And I, for me, it's a matter of finding the right story with the right character. But yes, I would love for that to happen. And I completely agree that we, and I don't know if it's just our culture, Mormon culture, if it's a problem that we have, it's probably actually a problem that everybody has, of stereotyping. I do have, Hawaiian history is something that I'm really fascinated with. You know, in the seventh grade, when you take, everybody in Utah took, you know, Utah state history, you take the history of the state you're living in at the time you're in seventh grade. And for me, it was Hawaiian history. And it really is fascinating stuff. And no one, I don't think Americans in general, you know, they think Hawaii is this place where you go to go on vacation and you go to the PCC and you eat luau food, you wear a lei, and that's all that anybody knows about Hawaiian culture. And there's really, it's a very, it's a fascinating spiritual, family-based culture that, you know, I mean, there's so much love in Hawaii that you just don't know about unless you've been there and experienced it. So if I find a way to put that in a play, I would love to do it. I haven't found a way yet, but it would be really cool.
It would be. You know, I was, one of our perma bloggers, Viliami, he's half Tongan, and he shared with my brother Paul and I a video from a family reunion, and it was a traditional Tongan dance. And it was kind of, it was really interesting, because it was kind of showing the man, he was explaining the dance and what it meant, and kind of the man like submitting to the woman in this certain posture. And I was like, nobody knows about this stuff, you know? I mean, nobody knows. I want to hear more about that, you know, as opposed to just the luau's. And I mean, not that anything's wrong with that, because my wife is actually part of a Hawaiian dance group here in town that's headed up by a Hawaiian, and she started playing the ukulele for some reason a month ago, and it's been really fun. But it's a shame that it's been narrowed down to what it is, and especially with such a rich Mormon story there that we have of devout, you know, Hawaiians and Tongans and Samoans and Maoris and things like that. There's just, it just seemed like the story, there's something there that I don't know anything about.
No, I totally agree. I think, Polynesian culture is so interesting, and Polynesian people are so wonderful, and there's so little that we know and understand.
I think we'll move on to our last section here. We're just going to talk a little bit. Bleh. We're just going to talk a little bit about Freetown, as we alluded to earlier in the podcast. And I just wanted to know, I just want to hear about the background of the film, like why the filmmakers decided to make it and how they got a hold of you, how that happened. And then I'll, continue on from there.
Garrett Batty, who is the director and one of the producers on Freetown, is the writer-director of another recent LDS film, The Saratov Approach. And it was one of the more successful LDS movies of the last several years, and one of the better made, I think. And it did really, it had a really great response to it. It's really hard, and this is, to go back to what we said earlier about writing for the Mormon audience. The Mormon audience can be really tricky, to get their interest and to get them to come out to the movies or to the theater can be really, really difficult. And the Saratov Approach, though, they managed to figure out that trick, and people came to the movie and people loved it, and it's doing really well. And I believe it's streaming on Netflix right now. And there's just been a lot of interest. And what's cool about the Saratov Approach, aside from the fact that, I think Garrett did a really bang up job on making it, is that it is based on a true story of these elders who were kidnapped on their missions, in Russia. And the film is inspired by actual events. And, at the same time that it has a spiritual side, it really is a thriller, and it's about these missionaries in a difficult situation. But it could very easily be about two guys who are just in a difficult situation, and they just happen in this scenario to be LDS. What I think is really great about Freetown is it also is inspired by a true story, by some really pretty incredible men who, to think about these missionaries who were just so dedicated to what they were doing, that they said, we just can't sit here. We can't just sit in Monrovia and not teach. We have to teach. We have to be in a place where we can do what we were called to do. And they kind of risk life and limb to get where they need to be, both spiritually and temporally. So Garrett is directing the film, Garrett Batty, and he, and I were friends at BYU years and years ago, and he sent me a Facebook message and asked me if I would be interested in working on a project with him. This was back earlier this spring, and I met with him, and Garrett's really great, and he's very talented. He's a really talented guy, and he's wants to make good films for LDS audiences, but also for non-LDS audiences, for a more general audience, to bring them. I think he would like to make LDS stories accessible to a more general audience, which is ambitious and great. And so we met and talked about it, and I worked on the script with him, and they are right now, Garrett, along with Adam Abel, who is the producer on the Saints and Soldiers series of films, another very talented LDS filmmaker. Garrett and Adam are in Ghana right now. They've been there, I want to say, a little over a week, maybe almost two, it may be 2 weeks tomorrow, doing pre-production. And this week is the first week of primary shooting. ended today. And so they have been working over there with a primarily African crew. And as far as I know, the casting is has all been done locally. There are only two roles in the show that are American, mission president and his wife. And I believe everything else has been cast with local actors. So wow. It's pretty exciting. Yeah, it's probably the first time that's happened, I think, with a major LDS film.
So for writing this, what kind of research did you need to do, since this particular situation is going to be very different than your typical mission experience?
Do you mean as far as, I mean, I did research. Well, I mean,
yeah, like where did you find the research for this to about the stories, about what happened, you know, about how life would have been like, because, like, you know, this particular scenario is not your typical mission experience.
Well, I did a lot of research into the period, because I know it's funny to think about 1990 being a period piece, but it kind of is. I mean, it's 24 years ago. Yep. To learn more about the Liberian Civil War, the causes of it, and what was going down, what things were like for people in the city. And the missionaries involved in the story, whose story it is, I should say, some of them there have been interviews with them, and there was an article. It's really interesting, because we had actually been working on the script for quite a while when there was an article about this very event, this very story that appeared in the June Ensign of this year. And I remember Garrett emailing me the link to the article in the Ensign, and I just went, huh, maybe this is supposed to happen right now. Okay, that's great. But there are a lot of interviews and articles and ephemera related to the story that are in available in the Church History Library. And then there's also some, so I did research into what was happening as far as, like, you know, the missionaries themselves, and then also the war as it was going on. And there are some things in the film that we had to take liberties with, but you try to make that as, you know, as honest and real to the situation as possible, so that you can't really, it doesn't glaringly stick out like a sore thumb and say, hey, this is the part of the film that didn't really happen. but as far as research, it still kind of fits into that genre of a historical piece. It's not Joan of Arc, it's not these and thous, the language is, but the language does have a very particular cadence. English spoken in Africa is different than English spoken in Utah or in California.
Yeah. My ward is about one fifth Liberian, so.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. it's really... a very different cadence.
So, yeah, I'm really excited about it. I think it could be. I think it could be pretty great. It's been really fun to be part of the process. And I really wish I was in there for shooting. I really wish I could be in Ghana right now.
Yeah, that would be kind of amazing.
It would be kind of amazing. Yeah. So right now, the film is slated for release in April of 2015. Yeah, I'm excited. April is going to be a busy month for me.
What else is going on?
It's nice to, as a writer, to say that you're busy. I have a play that's going on at a theater in Salt Lake City, Plan B Theater Company, and it will actually open the same week that Freetown opens.
Wow. Which is a multimedia crazy. Writer.
Yeah. So Freetown will open on April 8th, and then this new play, it's called Pilot Program, and it opens on April 9th. And it runs April 9th to the 19th at Plan B in Salt Lake.
And you wanted to give us a, like, brief synopsis of Pilot Program?
Sure. Let me talk to you. Oh, Pilot Program. Yes. Pilot Program is a supposition. It takes place in Salt Lake City 5 years in the future, in 2019. And it's the story of a faithful, childless LDS couple. They are professionals. He is a PR specialist, and she is a literature professor, and they're in their 40s. And they are called to be part of a church pilot program to reinstate the practice of polygamy.
What?
So
there's that.
So anyway, for those of you who are in Utah, especially the Salt Lake area,
and into polygamy,
you can see Mel's work, two completely different stories in the same weekend. Go to Freetown as it premieres, or you can see live theater, Mel's work, Plan B. You can go to both and compare.
Yeah, which one is the romantic comedy, I wonder?
Where did this idea come from? I mean, is it just because you're Mormon, or this is pretty I actually like the idea. It's crazy town, because you get the old-timers that are like, you know, old-timers like 70, oh, yeah, you'll come back, you know, and so it's kind of, where'd the idea come from besides you, the fact that you're Mormon?
It's been floating around for a little bit, and it's something that has been, kind of on the back burner in my brain for a couple of years, actually. And it was just until it was last fall, I think, that we first, I don't know why I'm using the royal we, when I first committed a draft to paper, started to, you know, really form out the characters. Being single in the church is tricky. It's a hard thing. And sometimes people will say things that they don't mean to be harmful that are harmful, because, you know, people do that all of the time, not just at church. And one of the funny things that has been said to me in the past, as a single woman, is that, don't worry, you'll find the guy you're meant to be with in the millennium. And I'm like, is that supposed to be comforting? Am I supposed to look forward to that? Oh, gee, thanks. That's swell. And then, you know, there have been jokes about, you know, that guy, when you find him in the millennium, that he's already married, because there's an adage, you know, the good ones are all already married. And I think about polygamy, and I think about, from a Mormon perspective, how difficult it must have been for those families who both practiced it and then had to, almost as quickly as they had to adopt it, let it go. And how those families were just kind of shaped and torn by this practice. And at the same time, there are countries and cultures throughout history where polygamy is a perfectly okay thing. And it's not a joke, and it's totally fine. And it's the way that families are, and it's what's expected, and you do what's expected. And so I just, part of me, was just thinking about, if that were to happen, and it's a great big if, it's a totally hypothetical, if the church were to reinstate, polygamy, the part of me, the speculative autobiography part of me, the part of me that was like, if I was gay, how would I deal with it? Asked myself, if I was asked to be in a polygamous marriage, how would I deal with it? And it seemed much more interesting to me personally to try to deal with that in a contemporary setting as opposed to a historical one. It seemed like a more of a challenge for me because I click so easily into the historical. And then also with recent events in Utah politics, in relationships between the church and the government here, the decriminalization of polygamy, the fact that gay marriage is happening here and happening, you know, all across the country and all across the world. It actually became much more plausible. Whether or not it will actually happen, I don't know. But it became so plausible for the church to possibly bring back polygamy. And then I thought, well, shoot, if the church brings back polygamy and here I am a single woman in my 30s, am I going to be expected to be somebody's second or third wife? And how is that going to go over? Anyway, that's where it started. Crazy imagination.
Okay. And here's my two words, holy crap. That
right?
sounds so freaking interesting. Well, because I'm a dude and I'm married, so I'm like, I don't think about, well, I think about polygamy, but I don't like it. So I'm like, it's never going to happen. It's kind of my view of it. But it's interesting to hear you as you kind of wrestle with the idea and think and contextualize it into the 21st century mainstream LDS church. Yeah. So, of course, my follow-up question would be, are you going to be sending a personal invitation to Brian Hales to come watch it? Good, you got the joke. I was afraid it was going to totally suck. All right, thanks. Thanks for laughing.
No, but okay. If he comes up, turn him away.
Okay.
And see, again, it's kind of I have the same feeling with this one that I felt with Little Happy, where I'm like, both. I know that this is the right time and the right place for this play to get produced. At the same time, that I'm terrified of how the LDS audience is going to respond to it. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go over. Where I guess we're going to see. And that's part of, I think, I mean, that's the drama behind the drama.
Well, yeah, no one's written about polygamy as far as, you know, a dramatization of it that is actually a faithful LDS person. I mean, you know, for a play or for a TV show or anything. So, mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see it through that lens. Yeah, this is muy interesante.
They should have Paul go.
Oh, yeah, have Paul. Oh, yeah, we'll send Paul. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Is he in Salt Lake?
He's in right there in the buckle of the Jello Belt in Provo, Utah.
Fantastic. Yeah, send him down.
Yeah, and he can sit next to Brian Hales.
Oh, if they sit together, people are going to think something else is happening.
That'd be a good combo right there. Okay, I'll shut up now.
Questions. The one other thing that I really love about drama is that it's a safe place to ask questions. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, Brigham Young suggested that we as a people embrace the theater. But it's not always taken that way, which is unfortunate. Sometimes the asking of questions is seen as almost as a sin in and of itself, which I think is both wrong and sad. If we can't ask questions about ourselves, if we can't laugh at ourselves in a fictional context, what are we doing every day of the rest of our lives, taking ourselves too seriously?
All right, so that was our interview with Melissa Leilani Larson. Thank you for joining us, and thank you, Michael and Brian, for recording and editing. Anyway, we will include a series of links for Melissa's upcoming projects, as well as her website, where you should be able to listen to the audio version of the play, Little Happy Secrets. So thank you again.